Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the June 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. The program I had planned for this morning, an interview with Syrian-American professor Elaine Hagopian about the situation in Syria, had to be canceled at the last minute because she had a family medical emergency. So in about 20 minutes, after I give you some news and opinions about what's happening in the world, I'm going to pretend that it's the fifth Wednesday and open the phones to you and get your takes on the world. Meanwhile, my own thoughts on Syria. Well, there are a number of people on the left who would have us believe, as they say about Syria, that the Syrian protests are the product of what the government used to call us protesters in the 60s, outside agitators, that those who have been killed and imprisoned have simply been manipulated. What has been happening to a major segment of Syrian society at the hands of its government and its army is an ongoing crime that nothing can mitigate. I, too, am of the opinion that a variety of outside forces have inserted themselves in both situations because that can be expected to happen when dictatorships are in the process of coming apart and a certain degree of chaos reigns and forces across and outside the political spectrum are looking for an opportunity to seize. And in this case, in Syria, that includes both the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood and the CIA and its affiliates. And in Libya, it seems that the opportunists in league with NATO have clearly seized controls of that rebel movement. Far from the scene of the fighting, they appear to be organizing profit-making enterprises while calling for more bombs to drop on their fellow Libyans. NATO, disregarding a UN resolution that called for little more than a no-fly zone, has now determined that it can bomb wherever and whomever it wishes and has made Gaddafi and his family one of its targets. Already, as was to be expected, some of NATO's bombs have killed innocent civilians, although the level has not yet risen to what it has in Afghanistan. Having seen what their colleagues in the Security Council have done with a mild resolution on Libya, neither Russia nor China are willing to do the same when it comes to Syria, regardless of what is happening on the ground, because as Libya has again proved, it's easier to start a war than to end one. Syria also brings a far more complex problem than does Libya on the geopolitical scale. Whereas Libya, a country of but 6 million people, not including its foreign workforce, and aside from its oil reserves, is not and has never been a significant player in Middle East politics, despite Gaddafi's earlier efforts to make it one. This is apparently one of the reasons that Gaddafi has focused his attention and much of Libya's oil profits on sub-Saharan Africa, where he is considered in many places to be a hero. Syria, on the other hand, is an important regional player, located between Lebanon and Turkey, with Iraq on its eastern border, and maintaining its stability to this point, has been seen as more important in Washington than its politics, the views of the pro-Israel lobby being the notable exception. What bothers Israel and its U.S. supporters, of course, is that Syria is not only Iran's closest ally in the region, it also provides political backing and arms to the Lebanese militia and political party Hezbollah, whose ability to stop Israel's 2006 invasion force made them heroes throughout the Middle East and beyond and humiliated the world's fourth largest army. Being dependent on Syria perforce, Hezbollah was obliged to issue a statement backing the Syrian government's crackdown, much as Fidel Castro believed he had to do when he supported the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968. Since foreign press had been barred from entering Syria, what the world has seen and heard of its murderous crackdown on protesters has only been through crude, out-of-focus cell phone images taken by frightened but brave Syrians that have been sent to Al Jazeera and picked up by other networks, and by calls from those same cell phones to the media from some of the thousands of Syrians who have fled for their lives across the Lebanese and Turkish borders. President Obama's last comment on the Syrian situation came in a talk at the State Department on May 19th, in which he outlined his administration's policy toward the Arab Spring and called for Syrian President Bashar Assad to lead his country to democracy, quote, or get out of the way, unquote. The Syrian government, said Obama, has, quote, chosen the path of murder and the mass arrest of its citizens, end quote. And he praised the Syrian people for their courage in standing up to the repression, which already had killed hundreds. His failure to take stronger action in Syria has led to a wave of criticism in the Washington press, led predictably by the neocons with Elliot Abrams in the vanguard, who are pretending to be the champions of, quote, democratic regime change, quote. Serious questions have been raised as to who in the Syrian government is directing the crackdown, and his speculation has been that it is his younger brother Mahar. If so, he'd be following in the footsteps of his father Hafez Assad, who put his own brother Rifat in charge of eliminating resistance in the town of Hama in 1982, in which at least 10,000 and maybe 25,000 alleged members of the Muslim Brotherhood were murdered and the town virtually destroyed. In a rambling speech at Damascus University on Monday, Bashar Assad decried accusations against his family members, and once again, he has since the beginning of the uprising, as he has, promised democratic reforms, which, if he wished to do so, he could implement immediately. Yesterday, after activists and analysts had dismissed his latest promises, Assad issued a general amnesty, the second of its kind, in 3 weeks. It includes anyone who was accused of committing crimes through Sunday, June 20th, according to the state news agency Sana. After the first amnesty, Syrian authorities freed hundreds of political prisoners, but rights groups say there are still thousands languishing in Syrian jails. Also on Tuesday, tens of thousands of Syrians turned out for pro-Assad rallies in Aleppo, Damascus, and the southern city of Dara, where protests against Assad first erupted in mid-March. People waved the country's tricolor flag, carried pictures of the president, and flew red and white and black balloons in the air. According to some activists, government employees were paid to be there, to appear there, and army forces came in civilian uniforms. Meanwhile, less and less is heard about Bahrain, home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, whose motto must have been taken from the attitude of the Obama administration to the crimes of that country: hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil. In his May 19th speech, Obama described Bahrain as a, quote, long-standing partner, and the U.S. is committed to its security. "We recognize," he said, the president, without providing any evidence, "that Iran has tried to take advantage of the turmoil there, and that the Bahraini government has a legitimate interest in the rule of law. Nevertheless, we have insisted publicly and privately that mass arrests and brute force are at odds and with the universal rights of Bahrain citizens and will not make legitimate calls for reform go away." "The only way," Obama said, "the only way forward is for the government and opposition to engage in a dialogue, and you can't have a real dialogue when parts of the peaceful opposition are in jail." "The government," added Obama, "must create the conditions for dialogue, and the opposition must participate to forge a just future for all Bahrainis," end quote. The result? The Bahraini government has put on trial scores of doctors and nurses who treated the victims of the governmental crackdown and charged them with trying to overthrow the government. You heard this morning that it has sentenced a number of Bahraini activists to life imprisonment for trying to overthrow the government. It has also filed a suit in Britain against journalist Robert Fisk, who was on the scene at the time, and who, writing in the London Independent last week, suggested the ruling Khalifa family had gone mad. "Doctors I saw drenched in their patients' blood," wrote Fisk, "desperately trying to staunch the bullet wounds of pro-democracy demonstrators shot in cold blood. Bahraini soldiers and police are now on trial. I watched armed policemen refusing to allow ambulances to collect the wounded from the roads where they had been cut down. These are the very same doctors and nurses I stood beside 4 months ago," wrote Fisk, "in the Soleimani emergency room, some of them weeping as they tried to deal with gunshot wounds, the likes of which they had never seen before," end quote. That's Robert Fisk. And Obama? According to Agence France-Presse, he dropped by a meeting on June 7th between Bahraini Crown Prince Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa and U.S. National Security Advisor Tom Donilon in a White House protocol mechanism used to allow the president to meet lower-level officials. White House officials said the Obama reaffirmed the strong U.S. commitment to Bahrain and welcomed King Hamad's plan to end, quote, a state of national safety, end quote, and the announcement that national dialogue and reform would begin in July. In addition, last week, the U.S. put Bahrain on a list of its human rights violators to be scrutinized by the U.N. Human Rights Council, along with Iran, North Korea, and Zimbabwe. By the end of the month, an international flotilla of up to 10 ships will be challenging the Israeli blockade of Gaza, and the Israelis, who were widely criticized for the killing of 8 Turks and 1 Turkish American on the Mavi Marmara, are trying to make sure that they are not embarrassed again. Last Wednesday, the Israeli Navy held a large-scale exercise that involved Navy commandos from Flotilla 13, better known as Shayetet, as well as other Navy units and special forces from throughout its military establishment. In stopping and boarding of the ships, the Israeli teams will be supported by snipers, whose job, according to the Jerusalem Post, will be to neutralize violent protesters before the commandos board the ships, and with dogs from Oketz, the IDF's canine unit. Neutralize, in military jargon, means to kill. But how they will determine who is or isn't violent before the Israelis board the ship, they don't say. The Israelis announced that they are preparing for a wide range of scenarios, from the possibility that they will encounter passive resistance to the possibility that they will be met once again by what they describe as, quote, mercenaries armed with knives, saws, bats, as well as guns, end quote. The Turkish activists who bravely resisted the boarding Israeli soldiers last May and were killed had at best only some kitchen knives and pieces of boat equipment that they were able to scrounge. It was the Israelis who had the guns. The murder of the young Turkish-American Furkan Dogan, who was shot while lying on his back, was captured on a cell phone camera, one that the passengers managed to hide from the Israelis. The Mavi Marmara had been scheduled to be part of the new flotilla, but given the ongoing turmoil with Syria, the Turks withdrew, and a French boat that was set to sail was stopped by law, a lawsuit brought into court by the French Jewish community. A similar attempt was made on a U.S. court by a former American Jew now living in Israel to stop the American ship, the Audacity of Hope, from sailing. The Audacity of Hope, named after the book by President Obama and carrying 50 passengers, is one of the 10 boats that will be part of the Freedom Flotilla II, Staying Human, set to sail any day now. Among the passengers are author Alex Walker, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, retired U.S. Army Colonel Ann Wright, anti-war Iraq war activist Kathy Kelly, and 87-year-old Holocaust survivor Hedy Epstein. The boats, which have before, will be carrying humanitarian aid and essential building materials, which still have a hard time getting into Gaza. But this morning, I just had some news this morning, that Israel has approved the delivery to the Gaza Strip of materials to build 1,200 homes and 18 schools in UN-run projects, a defense official told Avant Press. The decision came shortly before the scheduled departure of an international convoy seeking to breach Israel's naval blockade of Gaza, and as Israeli officials argued that there is no humanitarian crisis there. They said it had nothing to do with the planned flotilla sailing. The Audacity of Hope will be joined by boats from Canada, the Tahrir, from Ireland, the Saoirse, Britain, Norway, Greece, from Italy, named for my late friend Stefano Chiarini, from Scotland, the Discovery II, Germany, Sweden, Spain, France, Switzerland, and the Netherlands. On Sunday, Israel Navy Commander Admiral Eliezer Maron issued a stark warning to the peace activists. Quote, "The Navy has prevented and will continue to prevent the arrival of the hate flotilla, whose only goals are to clash with IDF soldiers, create media provocation, and to delegitimize the State of Israel." Unquote. Yaakov Katz, writing in the Jerusalem Post, is pleased to tell his readers that, quote, "One lesson that has been learned already is the need to disseminate information to the media immediately. Last year, on the morning of the flotilla," he wrote, "it took IDF spokesman Brigadier General Avi Benayahu some 5 hours to release an official statement and around 10 hours to release the video showing the commandos getting ambushed and lynched aboard the Mavi Marmara," end quote. Note the Israelis, always the victims, love to use the word lynched when one of their soldiers is attacked, even when their soldiers happen to be the ones doing the attacking. Well, this time, adds Katz, the new IDF spokesman, Brigadier General Yoav Mordechai, has decided to set up all the necessary mechanisms so there will not be any excuses for delays in distributing the information. The Navy will transmit footage live back to Tel Aviv headquarters, and the spokesman's unit will set up a studio at sea and on the coast to review and edit footage and then distribute it to the press in real time, end quote. Well, that's not likely, actually, since if they follow last year's procedure, it will take a little time to put the footage in order to put over the Israeli spin, and this time the boarding pirates will make a more determined effort to confiscate the cell phones of the ship's passengers. Tartuffe, you see, has long been an anathema to the only democracy in the Middle East, and our America's good ally, I should